as second-class citizens. One of my saddest observations is the answer so often given to my question, directed toward an individual who is unknown to me. What are you? The reply, usually said in a hangdog way, I'm native, stamps that person in his own eyes as something different from and not equal to other Americans. He seldom responds Eskimo, Athabascan, Tlingit, or Haida. There are some natives, like Howard Rock, who have passed beyond this stage and realized that their inheritance is an honorable one. There are other aging natives, such as my adopted grandmother, who proudly says, I'm 100% pure Eskimo and I'm proud of it. But comparable to the description of American national character by Jeffrey Gorer, younger natives reject the old ways as well as the old culture and are ashamed of their native background. One pretty young informant confided over a hamburger that while she was attending beauty college in Dallas, she made up her eyes and passed as a Nisi and found that she had many more dates. Who wants to go out with a native? Summary statements of native ethos are difficult to make without either offending some individuals or omitting many positive exceptions. Hear, hear. Most natives know that they are poorly educated. As a result, they are unable to cope with the legal and administrative jargon, some of which is almost a foreign language to them. They do not comprehend nuances of meaning. A high school graduate may know the term implement is a synonym for a tool, but to implement a project leaves him wondering just what kind of tools white man is going to bring in now. Many of them just sit at village council meetings and sometimes doze, looking disinterested, without participating. Actually, they realize that they should speak out, express their needs or their viewpoint, but they're afraid to do so. Then white man criticizes them for lack of native leadership. Native embarrassment in this respect cannot be overemphasized. Even in construction work, it has been repeatedly noted that a native is given instructions on how to perform a given operation. When asked if he understands, he invariably says yes and proceeds to do it entirely wrong because he is ashamed to say, I don't understand. The native also admits that he does not understand government procedures. In villages and even larger towns, natives do not participate in the mainstream of American bureaucracy. For some decades at least, he has had the teacher, the visiting nurse, and the doctor for guidance. These services are akin to Aboriginal positions, and these he understands. Our complex industrial world now introduces alien ideas, such as village incorporation, patented land, and clear title. Even adoption and divorce have been regulated. He does not know that he may be eligible for a loan under the Small Business Program or how to obtain redress through the Better Business Bureau in the event that a Seattle fur buyer accepts prime pelts but pays only for the lowest grade. In essence, he does not know the nature of the many services available to him or how to take advantage of them. The native is poorly educated and finds great security in reading comic books. I have gone into many homes to find mature natives, leaders in their community, reading children's comic books. When the opening door revealed it was a white who had come to call, the books were hurriedly concealed under a pillow in the hope that their reading material had not been observed. The native retains the image of model houses in Better Homes and Gardens magazine. Repeatedly, natives have apologized for their houses, adding, "We are a messy people." Small houses with many people inevitably lead to a storage problem. Cabinet work is expensive, both in material and labor, and closets and cupboards are a luxury. Few of us would want to receive unexpected guests in our garages, which are the approximate size and nature of many native homes. Many natives are painfully conscious of their mongoloid racial affiliation. Among the Eskimo especially, shortness of stature is a distinct disadvantage to the men when placed where they must interact with a number of white males. It has been suggested by one of the Eskimo native leaders that a major factor in the annual binge of drinking associated with the National Guard strike is the fact that the Eskimo, and native in general, feel small and therefore incompetent in association with the taller whites. Natives believe that even illegitimate half-breed children have a greater chance of success, not because of culture, but because they profit from the genes of the white male parent. Some native individuals have even suggested that extensive mixed marriages would improve the role and self-image of the native. The native from outlying villages is afraid to be around many whites, yet he longs for the bright lights, the boarding schools, and the excitement of the cities. Most natives from this background cannot cope with the routine of the 8-to-5 job and 2 weeks vacation. The memories of childhood without stringent rules on truancy and the love of woods render unendurable the noise and pace of the city. Records of relocation efforts are, in my opinion, dismal. Job instability, drinking, and the eventual return home are the rule. Employers on construction jobs in the Arctic continually fight against absenteeism by natives who simply take off for a day or two on a hunting trip. To hunt and fish is a part of a way of life, and responsibility to an employer, except for money, is apparently an acquired trait. The native is also afraid of other minority groups, especially Negroes, whose position is somewhat analogous to his, but their large numbers threaten the position of the native. He is afraid of being swallowed up in the bigness of American ghetto life, without the cohesive value of being able to retain his native and group identity. The native expects to be treated with prejudice, socially and in terms of employment. Within Alaska, his mongoloid appearance and his poor clothes indelibly stamp him as a native, and he therefore expects to be treated as indolent, as stupid, as an alcoholic, and as a second-class citizen. Again, the handicap of poor education relegates him to menial labor or welfare, and the available housing reflects his low economic status. Eskimo Village in Fairbanks is such an example. The native is becoming increasingly reticent about his Aboriginal culture. The several thousand tourists who visit King Island Village in Nome and tread the beach of Kotzebue illustrate the point. The Eskimo have been increasingly annoyed by tourists who help themselves to pieces of meat, only to cast it upon the ground after a sniff, and by onlookers taking pictures of the bloody business of butchering. Last summer, 1968, for the first time, Native women erected barricades of boxes and canvas to shield themselves from what they believed to be the derisive stares of white tourists. Natives at Gamble dream of a tourist hotel, which would bring outsiders to their village and provide seasonal employment, an outlet for handicrafts. The villagers at Point Hope have created a committee on tourism. It was my pleasure to sit in on some of their meetings, partially because my family owns a successful travel agency, and I could offer practical suggestions on advertising media and the services that tourists want. My admonition about the camera-loaded tourist wanting pictures of quaint ways fell on deaf ears in the fact of the potential dollars and the native's strong desire to be able to have some of the white man's luxuries, such as laundromats and movie houses, even in the villages. The native sees himself as deprived of excitement. He is bored. Young people especially complain there's nothing to do, even in the fairly good-sized towns of Barrow and Kotzebue. The community dances, games, and potlatches of former times have not been replaced. Drinking, fighting, and gangs offer some outlet for pent-up energies in the face of boredom and once again create bases for prejudice by whites. Although the native is becoming increasingly reticent to talk about past times and original culture, partially because he no longer knows much about it, he still retains an underlying sense of the social solidarity with the people of his group and his village, his language, and his inheritance. The few natives who have left Alaska and have successfully blended into Western society outside have, for the most part, married other natives, or native girls have married white men. Unmarried natives living alone often come back to Alaska, as they find too few among their new contacts who share any common basis of friendship based on background and experiences. They find they make acquaintances among their fellow employees, but no true friends, because others simply do not understand their home environment. They miss their native foods in the Great North Woods. The Bureau of Indian Affairs cooks at Mount Edgecombe know the popularity of occasional meals of native food. The native sees clearly that former values are changing, even among peers in his community. Ranked societies, such as those of Southeast Alaska, once set a standard of behavior and defined role and position. Anthropologists have accepted earlier judgments that Eskimo and Athabascans were essentially egalitarian societies, but preliminary research among the Eskimo now strongly suggests that elements of ranking were aboriginally evident. My fieldwork this fall will be focused in this area. The fundamental concept of sharing, so basic to survival prior to contact, is rapidly giving away to the individualism of modern society. Natives are no longer willing to honor the obligation of mutual sharing, which formerly carried the expectation of reciprocal aid. They now rank their peers as freeloaders, as welfare recipients, or simply as undependable. The loan of a harpoon or boat to a neighbor or cousin cannot be duplicated now in the lending of a snowgo or an outboard motor, because of the cash value that the latter represent and the potential monetary loss in the event of damage through careless use. Family responsibility and solidarity are also rapidly shifting. Traditional care of children and the aged no longer have the same meaning. Older members of Alaskan Native groups recall their youth when they supported parents and grandparents. Now they live alone, eking out their existence on old age assistance, and uncertain whether their descendants will either physically support or mentally sustain their declining years. The impact of increased medical aid has similar repercussions as in other emerging cultures. Children are not needed to assist in the food quest, and state aid to dependent children does pay the costs for store-bought food and clothing. Native language, a strong culture-bearing medium which has inherent in its very structure many ideas which cannot be readily expressed even in English translation, is rapidly disappearing entirely. To revive Boas' well-known analysis of the 100 Eskimo words for different types of snow, snow is still snow in English and can be modified only by adjectives such as wet, dry, and powdery. Many natives are ashamed to speak their mother tongue, especially if whites are present. Some totally deny their knowledge of the language. Youths tend to be derisive in saying, "Who wants to know that funny talk?" Summary. The natives of Alaska see themselves adrift, wondering what lies ahead. Somewhat tangential to this paper, but important to the perspective, is the awareness that the total image of America and Americans is changing. The American dream of a century ago, which proclaimed, as does the motto on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your poor," and which found strength in the development of a nation by the utilization of multiple talents mixed in the giant melting pot, is fading. The large population, coupled with the high level of technology, no longer requires or produces the kind of folksy neighborliness that helped a new settler roof his barn. The recent emergence of a series of pan-native movements in Alaska may be compared with the contemporary splintering of American society into a mosaic of ethnic and social groups, each a vehicle for some form of identity or power for jockeying of positions. In Alaska, the traditional enmity between Indians and Eskimo may be erased at least superficially, but cultural traditions die slowly. Enmity may predictably emerge in the form of factionalism within the native movement, making these organizations less effective than some anticipate. To the degree that they are successful in providing unity, the Alaska Native may find self-direction in adopting and adapting to new value systems.
Thank you, Mr. Salisbury. So now, ladies and gentlemen, we have finished the presentation of the papers and the views. We shall now take a break until... The message is that the coffee is ready in the corridor. There's also another message. There are no more chairs available, I suppose. So we would like to meet sharp at 3:45. Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, we would like now to call upon Mr. Lee Salisbury, who has the job of being a discussant. I would think that this is about the same as a pump primer. I think he will get things going. So I would call on Mr. Salisbury from the speech department.
Thank you, Dr. Lyons. Harking back to the first paper we heard from Professor Hippler, recalling Bob Arnold's paper. Shortly after that, I think you as I may have felt that there was some contradiction, and I'm sure that this is not actually so in fact, but may seem to be a contradiction in what both gentlemen stated about the village. Mr. Hippler indicated that he thought that villages would remain viable units for some time to come, and Mr. Arnold seemed to say just the contrary, and viability seemed to be measured in terms of the number of people remaining as opposed to those who choose to leave, and perhaps we could have both of these gentlemen comment to this. Art, you first, I think, because you raised it.
Yes, okay, I think that it would have been much easier, in fact, had I read the paper. I didn't know that we could. I thought it was necessary just to summarize them. And I think it would have been much clearer then. And the term viability was just sort of pulled out as I was going along. It didn't have any particular more meaning than the word honorable does in front of a judge's name. But I was essentially saying is that in terms of population stability, what I had once believed, and what I think many people had once believed, that, in fact, Alaskan Native villages were going to disappear, if not too soon, certainly within the foreseeable future, another 15 or 20 years, they'd be almost all gone. I think that this wasn't true. It was more, perhaps, a projection of many people's desires, because naturally problems are a great deal less if you can ignore them. And one of the problems of having Alaskan villages continue to remain at nearly the same population levels that they are is just the kind of thing Martha was talking about. They have very grave needs for sanitation, for good water, for medical assistance, for education, for access to cash, for skill training, and so forth. These are very expensive services to provide for people who are scattered in 180 or 190 small communities all over the length and breadth of a 600,000-mile area. That's really quite a problem in administration. And I think this colored the perceptions of many of us about what it is, what was going to happen, our hope that maybe it would. But it seems very clear from the data that I have now, which I don't think contradict Bob's, that the villages will remain. What Bob was saying, as I understood, was that they're going to remain in a state of rather unfortunate poverty. I think that's clear true. Yes.
Like Dr. Hippler, I do believe that villages are going to persist, and I didn't mean to indicate judgments even against this in this characterization. I think there is to return to the word viable, there is a peculiar viability that may not appear viable in terms that we would set out. A successful combination of seasonal employment together with gathering activities, National Guard income, and for some, welfare, temporary relief checks coming. I think it would be difficult to characterize from our standpoint, where we think of 12 months a year job and money in the bank as being in kind of a viable position as a person, to use the word in that sense for villages. But I didn't mean to indicate that I believed villages would vanish. I think they show a great persistence. And for many of them, though it's not the combination of things we're accustomed to, they show a peculiar viability and a satisfactoriness to the people who live there.
This, I think, is borne out by some observations that those of us in Upward Bound have had a chance to make this summer with Native young people who have, in the course of the six-week program, become intimately acquainted with some of the issues of the land claims controversy, which is presently in progress. And many of them have stated that although they are going on in education and are seeking college education because they don't feel that there is any future in the village economically for them, that the university and school is training them for positions which are simply not found in rural Alaska, that if the land claims are settled as the as the native groups hope that they will be, with large portions of land surrounding villages and local corporations administering large sums of money in clearly defined regions throughout the state, that this may give them a feeling more of belonging back in the village where some economic viability may exist because of this. I suppose my objection really to the paper that I read to you is that Dr. Smith's observations don't coincide with my own. I have not heard any of the native people that I have worked with say these things, and undoubtedly she has. Perhaps the answer is that Ms. Smith worked a great deal in Kotzebue, which is certainly not a typical Alaskan village. And my contact with native students or natives is when they are entering college, and this is a rather narrow spectrum of Native people who I think are the new generation which is emerging, kids who see themselves as, perhaps as Dr. Lyons would put it, orphans of both cultures, but at least they have a lot of company, and perhaps you're not so much of an orphan if you've got a lot of friends in the same boat, which gives me, I take hope from this, because so often in the past, I think people who are in the process of making a transition, and somehow we fallaciously assume that a transition involves moving from point A to point B, and when you're at point B, you lose all the characteristics you had when you were in point A, that there is a place in between that is, to use a corny word, viable. There are certainly enough people in that position with whom you can identify, and there seem to be larger numbers, at least in Alaska, than would appear to be in Canada among the Native people who are in this position of understanding both sides of the fence and being able to operate with some discomfort, but relative ease in both cultures as well. So I think this is... This is something that I missed in Dr. Smith's paper, that, you know, the old culture was being eroded and nothing was taking its place. And I think that there is hope in this this large group of, for the want of a better term, marginal people who will be able to operate successfully. Perhaps I'm overly optimistic. I think probably the time has come to open this up for general discussion, Mr. Chairman, if you would.
Unless we have any more comments from the panel. Okay, we now open up to questions from the floor. Yes, sir.
I'm a little bit curious. You gave a dismal picture on the economic status of these villages. At the same time, you said, you know, there are various state and federal governmental agencies that are pouring money into these villages and hiring a lot of people to come on in. And it was also stated that none of the local people seem to be employed in any of the well-paying positions. Is there any particular reason for this? Aren't the natives interested in it, or aren't they smart enough, or doesn't the agency want to hire them, or... what's happening? It doesn't make sense.
Could I respond a little bit to that, Paul?
I'll begin and then invite Dr. Hippler to join me. I did say that the higher-paying positions in villages offered by government are more typically held by non-natives. The higher-paying positions typically are those of teacher, and though there are some Eskimo and Indian teachers in the school systems, they are not many in number. Government agencies do employ local people when they are available, and even have special programs in the case of at least two federal agencies that are very active in rural Alaska, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Division of Indian Health of the Public Health Service can give preference, in effect, to local people, to Alaska Natives in their employment program. There is a requirement for physicians and teachers and others to have achieved an adequate educational level, or sometimes it's a scientific kind of training. And when those things exist, they are employed. One other note with respect to teachers, and I think the educational situation among rural Alaskans is fairly well known. The educational level among adults is very low, between the fourth and fifth grade education. As of the 1960 census, we hope it's higher now. One other note with respect to, no, two, I think. Federal agencies at this time are making a renewed effort to employ not only in these two activities of education and health services, but in other areas as well, weather observer and flight technicians, flight service specialists and electronic technicians, and quite a range of jobs trying to open opportunities there through special programs to Alaska Natives, particularly in rural areas, but also in urban areas. One other thing, though, in connection with teachers, a number of acquaintances of mine who may be Aleut or Indian or Eskimo who have gone into teaching and have taught in villages have then turned to city systems or to other lines of employment. I don't believe there's a conscious policy in the case of federal agencies to exclude them from these positions.
Well, at least part of what I wanted to say, I think that you started to cover one of the things, is that I don't see why there's any reason to demand that Alaskan Natives stay in jobs in villages if they choose not to. If, for instance, an Alaskan Native school teacher chooses to move into a more well-paid school system, I certainly don't think that this person should be held back because we think it would be nice and colorful to have Alaskan Native teachers in the bush. But more fundamentally than this, most of the kinds of jobs, such as teaching or in the health services, do demand some professional expertise. This is a professional expertise which is not generally available to Alaskan Natives for a whole series of reasons which all of us know well. A long tradition of, to begin with, inadequate education, social and political segregation, racial prejudice, have all played a very significant part in this. At this point in time, when these factors are beginning to be finally overcome, there still is quite a deficit in terms of the abilities that are generally available, so that it's fairly difficult at times to find brain surgeons who just happen to be living in Tanana. These are difficult problems. They're not to be overcome overnight. And I'm not trying to be funny about them at all. There's an additional problem that goes to the core of what is it we're willing to pay for, how much, and when. And it has to do with this policy problem of how long we're going to be willing to do what are willing to do with Alaskan Natives and isolated communities. It is a tremendously expensive business to provide competent, high-level services for villages. I personally think it's not any more expensive than killing Vietnamese. On the other hand, there are many people who do and who are unwilling to put out this extra expense. It may well be that we'll find it takes 6, 7, 10, or 50 times as much per capita to overcome the cultural and educational deficiencies that we've created through a series of 3 or 4 generations of neglect. If that's so, it's certainly a minor enough investment in some ways. Certainly not in absolute dollars. It's not going to be terribly much. But proportionately, it's pretty expensive. That is a political decision. The decision whether or not to spend 50 times as much per capita in villages as in Anchorage and to try to overcome these deficiencies. You know, a political decision which, by the way, you can make.
Yes, sir.
To me, the panel tends to skirt the gentleman's problem without answering it head on. I've lived in a Native village for 35 years. I know something about them. Our organization has 6 plants. They're seafood processing plants. I have 2 Aleut superintendents, one of them of a plant with a gross product of over $4 million in 1968. I have a Tlingit superintendent, and I have a Blackfoot superintendent. Now, I suggest that perhaps the government hasn't tried to find qualified Native people for key decision-making executive jobs in the bush or anyplace else. The second thing I know from my own experience is that it's real rough to build an economic base in a small village. But I know that it can be done, and I know that you have to do it over the active opposition of the BIA and other government agencies.
Can I just ask Mr. Yes, sir, go ahead.
I wonder if there's someone from the BLM here. I'll tell what I know, that large numbers are employed each year as fires break out. They're paid at the same rates, depending upon skills, whether foreman or laborer-level firefighter, as others who are not natives. They are not pressed into service, in my knowledge, anywhere. I know when I was out in northwest Alaska a year ago, I think, the persistent complaint among villagers, I think it was along the Kobuk, at an equal employment opportunity conference, was that the planes had passed their villages by and thereby robbed them of that opportunity to earn some seasonal income.
Yes, sir.
I'm encouraged to find that Alaska hasn't gone as far along the welfare state sort of systems we have in Canada. We've actually started a large-scale Eskimo housing program in the Canadian North. Incidentally, I don't live in the North, and I don't spend any more time there than I have to. And one of the problems with this is that it's accompanied by a whole mass of people who tell the Eskimos how to make furniture out of old packing crates. When you figure out the cost of these programs of people telling people what to do, you find out you could air freight in a complete set of modern furniture to these places at less cost. One of the big problems that's come out in Canada, and we're getting over it, I think, I hope, is there is a technique out of French Canada called socialization. And this consists of actually doing a very radical thing like going down to the villages to the local people and saying, what do you think the problem is? Because we had a survey done, well, it was a commission of inquiry into the government of the Northwest Territories, and they actually went down and they actually asked the native peoples, and there are a very large number of documents on this, by the way, verbatim reports if someone wants to plow through them. And of course, many of the old people would say, well, I asked the government for a new set of false teeth, and it hasn't turned up yet, or when's my bed arriving? And simple things like this, a lack of a flow of information, whereas many of the whites were talking about, you know, liberty, democracy, fraternity, and all this sort of thing. But it is a well-developed technique where you actually sort of sit down, somebody comes from outside, and sits down with local people and says, what can you do to first of all identify your real problems, not those problems which we keep on hearing about in the North that we think are the problems of native peoples, and what resources you have, what ideas, what money, what access to information you have to solve these problems yourself. And then if you want any experts, you know, the old English idea that experts should be on tap and not on top. I think at least in Canada's North, we've got too many experts and too many people making a very good living going around among the Eskimos and the Indians and telling what their problems are and not enough people sort of sitting down with them and listening.
Thank you, Mr. Lutz. Yes, sir.
I'd like to footnote that last comment by asking why we have to have five white people present the native's point of view here, if indeed he is capable of analyzing his own situation and explaining it. And I think this is a general comment on the whole conference. One-third of it is supposed to be an analysis of the natives, and there seems to be a lack of natives both in the audience and on the various panels. Now this, as fact, seems to be a reflection of some people's analysis of how much the native can express themselves.
I think you're misreading the problem.
I mean, do you understand that?
What was it?
I didn't understand it, too. Yes, native.
But I was particularly concerned with Professor Smith's paper that she made frequent references to what the native expected, what was in the native's mind, and what the native was thinking. It seems to me that there are an awful lot of generalizations which are coming out of anthropology which get applied from place to place to place, and before long they're built right into the anthropologist's perception of what the problem is. Now, then getting back to what Professor Locke mentioned earlier, the other approach might be to go into a community and find out what people think. But I'm wondering how difficult it's going to be to get out of this circle of stereotype generalizations, or whether Professor Hibler, you think that some of Professor Smith's work is particularly valid.
Well, you said two different things. I'll try and isolate them out and see what you've suggested is that there are certain types of perceptions in the culture of anthropology itself, which mean that people who go out into the field to do field work take with them certain biases. I think that's true. I think it would be fairly difficult for any organized set of theory not to go into a new environment without some kinds of preconceptions. On the other hand, you've juxtaposed this versus the business of asking people what they really think. Well, of course, that's just what a good anthropologist is supposed to do, find out what the people think rather than to find out what he thinks about what they should think. And if you're asking me to judge Dr. Smith's work, since I didn't do her work and I'm not exactly sure what her methodology was, I don't really think that I could do that. If you're asking me for an opinion about whether or not what she has seen is also similar to some of the things I've seen, I'd say yes. I'd say you have to qualify that only by saying the following. In all human societies, at any given time, under any circumstances, there's going to be a spread of personality types, attitudes, abilities, contradictions, weaknesses. Any kind of human trait that you want to talk about is going to be on some sort of continuum in a spread in any society. At some times, under conditions of great stress and conditions of great social change, there is a substantial number of people who occupy a position that would have to be termed, in some sense, disturbed. And if I would be asked what my opinion is about Valene Smith's findings, I'd say that her findings are appropriate for a very significantly large number of young Alaskan Natives that I've met. I do not know whether that's a majority. I suspect not really, but a very substantial minority, I think. And I think we do nobody any particular service to try to deny this. If we're concerned about it, the next questions are policy questions. How does one overcome this? How do you overcome the fact of social segregation and prejudice? How do you overcome the fact of the racial hatreds that eventually build into the person who has hated a belief that they're actually inferior? I mean, this is not... That's a fact of life, and that must be overcome. I think no advantage is gained by denying that it happens.
Yes, ma'am.
I think this is the spot to interject a conference that was held a little bit. Bob, do you remember a Nome Job conference where the Natives did actually speak out and say what they wanted? Perhaps you could summarize a 3-day conference in 5 minutes or so.
It was that conference I was referring to a moment ago, though not quite in the same context, this Equal Employment Opportunity Conference that was held in Nome. And village representatives were there in large numbers to talk about jobs. And I was reminded of the conference during the intermission when I talked with a public health nurse who reminded me of the interests. I seem to be complaining about the absence of permanent jobs when the interest, in fact, among many villagers is for the old pattern. Seasonal employment for cash income together with some other activities for cash, and a preference for that seasonal employment over year-round employment. And I think this is one of the significant things that was noted at that conference. The second point, though, that you make regarding participation, I think for those who aren't familiar with RuralCap and its undertaking at 9 or 10 regional centers in the state, I should make mention of it, partly because it refers also to the previous question. At these regional centers established by RuralCap, the statewide anti-poverty organization, there are efforts being made to have the people of the region gather together or their representatives to define where it is they want to go, what things they need to do, and what things they want to do in what order, to give guidance to government and to give guidance in part, I suppose, to themselves. This is one illustration, I think, of increasing participation. I think every regional center has as its executive director a local person also, not a white government person. If Frank Peterson is here, he might like to speak further to these remarks. But a second illustration of a similar kind of thing is an EDA-funded project grant in Western Alaska. And under that grant, which went to the Alaska Federation of Natives, are employed two Western Alaskans in Bethel, an Eskimo, and in Kotzebue, an Eskimo. And these two men are working with people of those RuralCap boards and with government agencies to try to help give that further expression to what villagers want, so it doesn't depend forever upon the perceptions of government people about what the villager ought to have.
I'd like to answer a question that somebody raised, which hasn't been answered. Why there are no natives on this panel? Since I'm one of the people who had something to do with organizing a conference in general, I'd like to speak to that. If we were in the organization of a panel which is supposed to be part of a science conference and supposed to reflect some disciplined points of view, to have picked people solely because of their race, I think this would be exhibiting a kind of reverse racism, which is the most unfortunate aspect of many parts of contemporary life. It's less perhaps reprehensible than other types of racism, but it has a core of racism involved. How is it that Alaskan Natives enter to make their point of view felt about what it is that they believe, how they feel that they should respond to situations? In fact, if you don't invite them onto some kind of scientific panel, are you really not just sort of keeping them from getting any kind of ability to manipulate the circumstances that they're in. I don't think so. I think that what you're talking about is political action. And I'm encouraged to believe that in Alaska, Alaskan Natives have shown no less degree of political competence and political action than any other group that I've ever seen in action. Occurs to me that they don't particularly need my help in political action. On the other hand, if we're to try to develop some kind of a consistent, relatively securely, soundly based set of observations about social situations, then we pick people who know how to do that. Now, there were many, in fact, I can think of three natives, I believe at least one in this room, who were invited to participate in one way or another at this panel and who did not choose to. There were many people, there were, I guess, 11 or 12 people who were unable for various reasons to attend this particular panel. I mean, not everybody can come. Some people are at different places for different reasons. I am not attempting to be disingenuous. The fact is that all of the people at this conference have certain types of political points of view. That they do or do not happen to belong to a given racial group, I think is as much an accident of the history, the fact of that very history which we're trying to overcome, as anything else. I don't think we, again, help achieve the ends that we're trying to achieve by stacking decks on some racially based consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Epler. Yes, sir.
I'm Fred Selkring, and I'm the technical backup to the program that Mr. Arnold mentioned in terms of economic development in Western Alaska. And the one thing that I feel that I'd like to mention this time is something what the Englishman said. That
please.
One of these ethnic stereotypes. The technician should be on tap, not on top. And in terms of trying to find out what the native input should be in terms of surveying or going to village to sit down and talk with him, I fear that one of the problems in much of the OEO effort and in many of our efforts in the bush is a tendency to give them the guidance, if we're trying to make any sort of input, of saying that their priorities have got to match what's available. And my wife happened to be working some collaboratively at the same issue. She's with ATAP, and she's a planner, and her one big input has been to, in terms of political action from the villages, have the villages let them really express what they want. Let them determine their priorities in terms of what their needs are. So many of our programs are designed for the South 48, and they are not in any sense responsive to what Alaskan problems are. I feel that from political action, the part of the media is they have got to come up with a program for Western Alaska, designed for Western Alaska, that will do things. Part of the frustrations in my own role are that I see things that they're expressed, the native that they want and would like to see happen, but the implementation of them is almost impossible under the present form. I think that I'm going to break the logjam before my year of funding's over, but I feel that we've got to get some direction in terms of finding out what really are their priorities, 1, 2, 3, and what's one. And another problem is don't mix oranges and apples. I think that good health, good sanitation, economic opportunity are equal in terms of priorities in a village. And you can't say one goes ahead of another or that they want a Head Start opportunity for their children. These are different categories. And that the priorities in terms of categories is another area that the technique should follow.
Sir, would you like to speak to that? Yes, sir.
What has been the extent of research on white Alaska and how their perceptions of natives have formed? Because before, a lot of people told me that I could find out all I want to know about Native Alaska by going down Second Street. And it seems to me that tells you something about the way white Alaska perceives its native population. Another way, of course, is the lean air Alaska model of people that will perform ceremonials for anything like this. And is there any research in this area today?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. the difference between the perception of the happy, smiling native skinning a seal, which Lean and Air Alaska would like to make money off of, and the one that suggests that all natives go down on Second Avenue and get drunk. Of course, there's no real difference in these perceptions in terms of what they mean. But directly, no, there is not, as far as I know, any research since 1931 that's anything like anthropological research on whites in Alaska. I might be wrong, but that's the last one I know of. No, there is not. Who sounds like the AMA, Sam?
Perception of the Alaska Federation natives is turning out to be something like the AMA in both the editorials and selected letters of the Anchorage Times. There was a letter recently on Friday. This is a tricky problem. This letter I read Friday about a chap who was working up in the North Slope, and somehow he was laid off his job. And the rationale was that they were taking him off to get rid of so that they can hire native people. And he was very bitter about this. He said he was basically unqualified but very happy to get the job. Why should he be shoved aside? Then he turns around and then he, why this special for them when they're going to get $500 million, the 2% royalties and the land, and then he's and while they've got OEO, BIA, and some other various other organizations working for them, and I think that something really has to be directed to those guys down at the bottom of the economic scale in the state, and they can be rallied by special economic groups in the state for possibly disastrous results. And there has to be some idea of why those people think that.
There is ongoing research in the rest of the United States right now. I know several people who are involved in it, concerned with precisely this part of the population. The understanding is that a whole segment of the American population, perhaps as much as 20 or 30% of it, has more or less been bypassed in under two rubrics and two dreams. The American dream, which turns out really not to have really affected everybody at any rate, near the same rate, and the melting pot, which it turns out never really did quite melt. So that what you have in the United States, as you point out, and this is probably true for Canada as well to a lesser extent, there is a very substantial number of people whose skins happen to be white who, because they aren't playing directly on the guilt of those whites who have made a little bit more, aren't coming under certain programs which are oriented primarily towards people with different skin color. But to the point, I was just remembering, I asked Bill if he knew of any research at all in this area, and he doesn't either. But I'm reminded of Frank Vallee's work in Canada. The only one I can think of any recents in the north, Kabluna and Eskimo in the central Keewatin, where he attempted to talk about the relationships between white and Eskimos, and actually attempted to talk a little bit about the white population and the various groups. But still, no, it doesn't exist. Yeah?
I'm sorry. Bill, we can get on.
Yes.
Doesn't Dr. Ray have a book on Alaska Native dropouts, in which he states that the pupil expectations of white teachers were lower than the expectation of the Native parents? In other words, the teacher felt the child didn't need high school or other education, whereas the parents wanted this for the children. And it was rather astounding. Mm-hmm.
Some of that has even appeared occasionally in an article here and there, especially with regard to education. But a full-blown piece of research on the value systems and the perception of the non-native versus the native does not exist, and there's your opportunity. Yes.
On one point of information, I think somebody in this room who's doing research on teachers who come to teach, and there is a girl in Canada called Hilary White who's just completed a report on the adaptation of whites in El Cimeo and Kino. This is in the central Yukon. And this is the first study I know, because we initiated it, to sort of find out what's the problems on the other side. How they perceive the Indians and this sort of thing. And the concept of isolation. Everybody thinks of the North, it's terribly isolated, but all the evidence is that, you know, they run away to these places in central Yukon and they can't escape themselves. And this is one of the basic problems. There's nowhere else to run. There's always someone to look down on.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I'm Dr. Donald Friedman. I'd like to make some comments about the expectations on health, particularly for the native, but perhaps applies also to the non-native alike. And that has to do with what any one of us might expect in terms of health for ourselves, for our families. It depends upon what we see and understand relative to health. Since Dr. Wilson and others have pointed out the vast differences, at least statistically, in terms of health of the native and non-native, and referring to particular diseases that we have experienced and still know exist in Alaska, if we were to sit down and talk with natives and ask what they would like, what they would expect and hope for in terms of health, I'm not sure what the answer would be. I think we desperately need to do that, and particularly to go into some of the detail about what health does consist of, what relationship it has to the human resource, to the resources of the family, what it means in terms of being able to produce or to learn or to have qualities of desire to achieve or to do something else other than what they might be doing, or to live in a different fashion. What I'm trying to get at is that it's not easy to simply say if you have a particular disease, let's say tuberculosis, that this disables a person for quite a period of time, and therefore he might not expect to be able to achieve. If he has hearing loss, he's not expected to learn very much in school, or at least he's likely to have a great deal of difficulty. And yet, if the parent, if the family, and the young people themselves don't see any relationship in particular to their own personal good health, desire for good health, some knowledge of how to achieve good health, and whether it's worth it in the end anyway, then certainly they're not going to make progress along these lines by themselves. Now, if we talk about imposition, it's true, we can impose, we have been trying to impose our concepts of good health, and we've been doing a great job in many instances, particularly with communicable disease. It is possible to eradicate tuberculosis. It's not possible to eradicate cancer or some other disease where the individual has to be involved himself in making a judgment of whether his symptoms or pain or disease or fear is going to motivate him to seek help. So I think to try to bring this to a conclusion, what I'm saying is that if we're going to if we're going to listen, let us listen to their desires as well as our own desires, regardless of race, relative to health and what we conceive of as being health and something to be desired. And if it turns out not to be what we want, then so be it. But let us not continue to impose our wisdom and our thoughts about health on people who may not be ready for it, who may not desire it, and who may not appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Arnold a question. In terms of the proposed settlement for Native land claims issue, that it's the establishment of a corporation that will pay off over a 10-year period, do you really think that this, what I'm really interested in is what, I think this actual cash settlement as it comes up is going to make any difference to what's going to be a drop in the bucket?
I think there are others in the audience who can better answer that question, those who are in the Alaska Federation of Natives, about the possible consequences of the settlement. And I would defer to them.
Well, I'm aware of most of it, but
Maybe my trepidation at offering an opinion is increased by their being here. The range of the settlement of 500 million is now being talked about as the minimum kind of figure that might be awarded under the various proposals for settlement. But if I understood your question, would that be a drop in the bucket, or that's kind of a hard thing to assess. This settlement would not take the place of programs that government carries out for natives and for others. So this $500 million or more would be, it would be small if it were immediately distributed on a per capita basis. But the leadership, as I understand, has no, it doesn't envision any kind of action like that. But instead of investment in enterprises that will bring even a modest increase in the number of jobs at this village or that. And it may be that some of the investments will take place elsewhere than in the villages where resources are scarce. I didn't answer because I don't really know the answer.
What specifically I was thinking is that we put something like $46 million a year into Alaskan welfare for natives or agencies which supply some form of benefits. And I believe the yearly continual payoff from the corporation would only amount to another $25 million per year, which wouldn't even double what we have now. And what we have now is so grossly inadequate.
Well, those programs which exist, public education for the young, would continue to be offered. I suspect that the Alaska Federation of Natives would look in part to the planning of the Tlingit-Haida Central Council as it weighs the difficult decisions of how to spend that small, how to invest or spend or use that small award that was made by the Court of Claims, filling gaps in programs through grants or loans or providing training or college scholarships or a range of things. Whether it will be enough or not, I suppose the answer in part is that money, no matter how much of it is available, it's still not enough. It's always scarce. Housing, for instance, though a variety of housing programs exist, the condition of housing in villages in Alaska is deplorable. And it will be many years under existing programs for every village family to have a decent livable house, the one that will help prevent the spread of those diseases Dr. Wilson talked about. And I've heard discussions that some of the funds would be devoted to those kinds of ends for grants or loans. But also title is needed. Well, that's enough.
Yes, sir. My name is Couch again. I'm from the Psychiatric Institute. And Dr. Wilson, you made a comment about something, and I might have been a little asleep when I heard it. But something about there being some depression or grief reactions or something. About, would you repeat that and give me your basis of your data? Or why'd you make it?
I have no data on a research basis, but I do have a good deal of experience in working with patients who have had tremendous losses in their families. And one of the things that we've noticed repeatedly is the fact that so many of the patients who are having emotional problems, who are having problems with alcoholism or having problems in school, are those people who have had tremendous losses in their family. The extent to which the tuberculosis epidemic itself devastated the Alaska Native people, I think, is very poorly understood. So many of the people that you talk with now will find that often they are the only surviving member of the family. They may have lost several siblings to tuberculosis. They may have lost one or both parents in childhood. And another problem that not only the death losses, but the losses of their parents or siblings due to the other disruptions that I mentioned. And my feeling that those people who are most off base at this time are those who incurred such great losses and incurred them at a time when there was an inadequate opportunity to mourn, to recover, and to resolve their grief through the usual processes that we had. The losses were too great.
Just that might be right, and I will take that under advisement. However, it's pretty easy to call people depressed, particularly when you see them I just got back from Bethel, and it's pretty easy to look at the population and say anybody who lives there should be depressed if you're not acquainted with that village life. The other thing is that the Psychiatric Institute does not have a large percentage of admission for depression at all. And this question has come up time and time again, and in fact, we have some doctors who made the assumption that we must give a lot of shock treatment because we have all this depression. We haven't given shock treatment there in 5 to 6 years that I know of. We just don't see it, and I think one must be careful about making assumptions of this kind until we get a little more evidence, I think.
Well, I think that making a good, solid psychiatric diagnosis of depression in this group is hard. However, when you see people, a large number of people who are attempting suicide, and some very, very good efforts, some successful, and we did not diagnose them as being depressed beforehand, we see a good deal of social disruption and feeling that there is no future for them in any of the more positive undertakings, so that they get lost in some other undertakings like just alcoholism and getting caught in the revolving door, as we call it. That really doesn't lend itself well to a good, strong psychiatric diagnosis, and yet it doesn't seem to build for a good, wholesome life either. And I think a lot of this is not insoluble. I think that the losses, I think, are there. They're not retrievable. But a lot of good energy is being applied to solve these problems, and the people themselves are doing it. But they've got an uphill fight to make when they have been subjected to so many tragedies, I think.
Mr. Orbeck.
Yes, I'd like to address myself to that issue. I'd like to know the extent to which you're using traditional concepts of psychodiagnosis.